Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we're starting off cold, but we're also going to see more clouds here roll in because another cold front's coming into the area right now. We've seen some snow from north to south here develop. Logan was seeing some snow-covered roads, especially the secondary ones. We've had some issues here on I-15 up in northern Utah, but it's all progressing southward. So eventually you'll see some snow showers developing in and around Park City. This is another weak storm, so this isn't going to do a whole lot in terms of accumulations for both the city or mountains, with the possibility of 1 to 2 inches in mountains. But it could make for a short period of time for some slick travel, especially on secondary, untreated roads in and around Park City here in the kind of mid-morning time frame near midday. But overall, it will become scattered into the afternoon, but temperatures will be much colder today. We're talking only in the low to mid-20s here for those daytime highs. We'll be a little bit warmer tomorrow in the upper 20s. Same thing goes on Friday, upper 20s, but we'll see the development of more snow after a quieter day tomorrow. On Friday afternoon, for places like the Wasatch Back in Park City. And then by Saturday, we're seeing accumulating snowfall. Now, right now, it looks like between now and the end of day Saturday, we're looking in the 2 to 5 inch range, probably closer to 5 in Park City itself. Park City Mountain will be in the 4 to 7 inch range. So, another nice little storm coming in. And then behind that, it's going to get pretty quiet around here, pretty dry as well, and temperatures will gradually start to warm. And by the time we get to midweek next week, we're likely in the low 40s in Park City. But overall, a couple more little blips on our radar before we get to that point and, bring on the snow.
Great. Hey, thanks, Adam. And on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we've got Trent. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, so we have a beautiful sunrise this morning. That definitely will give way to increasing clouds and some snow showers this afternoon. As you just heard, not expecting a ton out of this one. Couple of inches of snow possible by this evening. We've been talking about it all year, dealing with this persistent weak layer. And, our job gets a little bit more complicated now when we start thinking about how likely is it to trigger an avalanche. So every morning I've got to wake up and figure out what the danger rating is. And we base the danger rating off the North American public danger scale. So the avalanche danger is probably somewhere between moderate and considerable. It's really hard to know exactly. The North American danger scale is actually broken up into three categories. So we have travel advice, how you would travel in the mountains, the likelihood, and the avalanche size and distribution. So based on travel advice, I would pick a considerable avalanche danger today. Based on the likelihood, so how likely are you to trigger an avalanche, I'd put it at moderate. And based on avalanche size and distribution, I would have a blend of moderate and considerable danger. So where does this leave us? Well, picture it just like playing the classic 1989 game Minesweeper. The game's objective is clear. The game's objective is clear to, move around a rectangular board containing hidden mines or bombs without detonating any of them, with help from clues about a number of the neighboring mines in each field. Sort of sounds like the backcountry to me right now, and it's true. As the likelihood of triggering an avalanche goes down, it becomes easier for us to want to get into bigger terrain or start riding an avalanche terrain. However, what hasn't changed is the consequences of triggering an avalanche. That remains the same. So just like Minesweeper, if we play a game with 200 mines on the field, we're more likely to hit a mine. And that's where we were about a week ago. It was almost certain that you would trigger an avalanche. But if we remove a number of mines from the field, it becomes less likely. This is also called probability. But if we hit or trigger a mine, we still lose the game. So for now, it'll remain possible to trigger a deadly avalanche 2 to 5 feet deep in an area where the slab of snow on top of our weak layer is much thinner. especially leery of terrain along the periphery of the Cottonwoods, meaning places like Mill Creek, the Park City Ridgeline, Lambs, Mount Air, and Snake Creek, and any of the transitional zones towards Bountiful and the Sessions. If this all sounds hard and confusing or you know, weird to understand, that's okay. Just take a step back and ride terrain that's under 30 degrees in steepness and continue to avoid avalanche terrain altogether. Personally, that's my plan this winter and moving in even into the next few months. I think it's a weird winter across the West. We've had 24 avalanche fatalities in 25 days across the Intermountain West, and the most recent being on Monday from Wyoming. So the bottom line, the avalanche danger is considerable, and this danger exists on many slopes at the mid and upper elevations. Like I was saying before, the avalanche danger is most prevalent on northwest to north to east facing slopes where the snowpack is faceted with a stronger slab on top. Also, again, there's a more pronounced danger where the snowpack is shallower and thinner in areas outside of the upper Cottonwoods. So I'd encourage everybody to make sure you get the full forecast at utahavalanchecenter.org and have a nice morning out there.
Thanks, Trent. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber, talking about this year's legislative session, as well as some other school district-related news. Park City Mayor Manager Matt Dias has a preview of this week's City Council meeting. Mayor Andrew Bierman joining us, adding to his State of the City address last week. Finally, Heber City Manager Matt Bauer and TO Engineer Jeremy McAllister have details on the large number of flights coming in and out of the Heber Airport, as well as an update on their master plan. Well, the Utah State Legislature down to its final 2.5 weeks on the fun with a recap of what's been done so far and what's out there regarding education legislation. I have Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
So is education funding set at this point?
It's pretty well set. The base budget bill included all of the commitments that came from the passage of Amendment G, as well as some other measures. There's about another $50 million to be finalized. That won't show up in legislation until Monday next week. But we're looking pretty good at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, how good do we look, given that we were kind of made whole for last school year and then for next, or I guess the current school year, as well as for next school year as well?
Yes. So they've made up for what was missing last year. There's still a few odds and ends that are still being pursued. But for the most part, we're looking good and really solid coming into the next year. I presented to the board last night that of the things that have passed, it's looking like the school district will be ahead about $1.2 million in state funding. So we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah. So when do teachers get their bonuses?
Good question. I just got notices yesterday that the monies will be flowing to the school district by the end of this month, which means it'll be in time for us to put that in the March payrolls.
Okay. And then when does next year's budgeting process start?
So our kickoff was actually last night. We did our budget outlook as to what funding sources can be expected both from the federal and the state levels, and then preliminary estimates on what property taxes might look like for the upcoming year. And so with that revenue picture in frame, we can start building in what the needs are and what we can fund for the upcoming school year.
Okay, but it sounds like you got more than $1 million to work with than you had.
Correct.
This year.
And that's positive. As you recall, we have a four-year compensation contract in place, and so that's sufficient funds to help us keep the commitments of the second year of that four-year compensation plan.
Yeah. So is the district talking about, or the board talking about any kind of new ways of bringing education to students? I mean, we used to hear a lot from our former superintendent about this notion of blended learning. Really haven't heard anything since she left. I mean, I guess given what we know now, it sounds like blended learning is really the future of education as we know it.
Sure, and we're getting a great deal of experience having gone through this COVID period as to what does fully remote look like, what is hybrid, which is a combination of being in-person and online instruction, and what does in-person look like and how can in-person be enhanced as well. So So we're gaining a lot of experience, not only from the end of last year, but through this school year. So that will definitely inform what our practices will be as we come into this next school year.
Yeah, and you also have Shad Sorensen, former superintendent of South Summit School District, now working at Park City School District in the Human Resources Department. He's got a lot of experience running the Silver Summit Academy and could certainly tell you how popular that school is. And I guess if Park City did something like that, I mean, is it something that the Highland Estates property is being looked at?
So the, you know, I'm not sure how the Highland Estates would click into that, but the idea, we've had conversations in the past with our other school districts next door and down the road. We've looked at different ways of combining and providing services, not only at the high school level and elementary level, but also through the CTE type programs. So we're definitely looking at options that are out there and ways to partner not only with, again, other school districts, but also with higher ed as well. So those conversations are definitely out there.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, given that we're still kind of making our way through this idea of how we teach kids, it may not be as traditional as we've always thought it is. And I guess, do we step back from the master planning and look at maybe we really don't need a bigger high school?
You know, we even asked that question back last spring. So when MHTN was on board and working with us and designing, and we asked them that straight up and said, hey, with the developments that are happening with COVID, with the expectations of social distancing and the ways in which learning is taking place, are we out of sync now with what we've put together? And they pretty much assured us that the way in which we're designing these spaces can support any of those modalities, so that our experiences from COVID actually don't slow down how we're looking at our facilities. There will still be facility needs in the future, and as long as those spaces can accommodate the different modalities of learning, we're in good shape.
Okay. Wanted to ask you, anything new with regard to the purchase, property purchase in the Highland Estates area?
Yeah, so that's, we're going through our due diligence, and so it's under contract right now, and hope to have all of that work done here shortly.
Yeah, is there a closing date?
So there's a tentative one based on the purchase agreement, which would put it, I think it's in April.
All right. Let's turn to some of the legislative bills. House Bill 60 was approved. This bill did away with the requirement for Utahns over the age of 21 to have a permit to legally carry a concealed firearm. Does this affect the school district at all?
I think the only change in that is whether or not you had to have a concealed carry permit. Our policies weren't necessarily written around concealed carry permit. It just had to do with a firearm on campus in any case. And so I don't know that we'll have any major revisions to our policies and practices, but we'll definitely have to take that to our legal counsel and make sure that we're in concert with the new expectations of the law.
So school districts can make their own rules with regard to bringing weapons on school property?
Yeah, we have some latitude in that area. It's not fail-safe, but we do have discretion there.
So are guns allowed on Park City School District property?
At this point, under the concealed carry permit, they can be, yes.
Okay. Let's see. Where does the school district stand on Senator Ron Winterton's school mask bill, Senate Bill 186?
So we didn't get onto that one last night as I was giving briefings on some other bills. That'll be an interesting one to see. We have a new health order that went out late Monday night that addresses some of those concerns that come from that bill. So we'll just have to kind of play it by ear and see if the bill passes, and then what that has to do with our coordination with the local health department and what we do on campus.
Yeah. What's the district's take on the House passing House Bill 302, Kara Berkland's bill, which denies trans girls the opportunity to play high school sports?
Yeah, that's a really challenging topic right now. At this point, our programs all operate under the Utah High School Activities Association policies. which has accommodations in place and has struck a balance in that community and with those concerns. And we follow those policies at this point. And to date, there hasn't been any challenges under those policies to determine that there's any discrimination taking place. So we'll continue to operate under those policies and then see where the legislation takes the conversation. I think on a different level, if we have a concern, it's more that the governmental immunity is removed for a number of actions that can be taken under this bill. And it's challenging for a school district because if we try to abide by the law, we could be sued by either side for discrimination and have no governmental immunity. And it would be unfortunate to have a school district put into financial jeopardy over this discussion.
Yeah, so have we had conflicts with trans students wanting to compete in athletics?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, Representative Berkland's case is that there hasn't been a problem, and so we should get out in front of it. And again, as you mentioned, complex, difficult, a fairness question on both ends with girls simply not being able to compete with an athlete biologically stronger and faster on an even playing field, and yet... Is there some talk about perhaps having some kind of co-ed competition so that girl athletes may not lose out on their college scholarships, but would certainly allow others to play together?
Again, I'm not aware of conversations at those levels. I'm fairly certain that should the bill pass, those types of conversations will definitely come forward.
All right. Let's see. Anything else that you've got your eye on then that you're concerned about?
Sure. Yeah, we're following... Well, we're following about 45 bills, and obviously we don't have time to talk about all of those. But we're definitely following like House Bill 105, which has to do with students with disability amendments. This changes the state formula so that there's actually more funding available in the schools to support the needs of those students. So we're very interested in that and hoping that that will pass because that will provide greater resources in the schools for our students. We're watching it. I just forgot what the number is, but there's a bill that's coming through that changes how we do our drills. So the emergency drills. It's been a little challenging to try to conduct those in a COVID environment. So House Bill 343 gives us a separate mode to go through and provide instructions for emergency evacuations and drills without actually having to walk through the procedure. So we're interested in that and seeing how that will progress because that will make things much easier in operations at the schools.
Okay. Real quick, can you give us an update with what's happening with preparations to run a possible school bond this fall?
Sure. So the financing options will be tailored to the project list that will come out of the discussions with the board. So there's a work session set for March 10th to go through the projects that have come through all of the community discussions we've had over the past 2 years and actually develop that project list with its phasing. That will then dictate for us what the financing target is and how to move forward. We haven't selected a particular financing scheme or combination of schemes. But what we have been doing is making sure that we're meeting all of the deadlines and reporting responsibilities and requirements of a general obligation bond because that's the most restrictive in that process. And we don't want to inadvertently miss that as an opportunity for discussion because we missed an earlier deadline. So it looks like we're going down a GO bond path, mainly because we don't want to miss any of their deadlines, should that be the ultimate decision for financing.
All right. Let's see. And can you give an update on the consultants who were brought on to manage the contract provider, not consultant, with the new staffing company to help you out with substitute teachers?
Oh, with EDU staffing?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so we've transitioned over onto that level. They are providing the support that we were hoping under the contract. We're probably, we're in February, so we're 2 months into that contract. And we'll obviously be following how well they do, see if our fill rates rise higher than the 85% that we had before, and make sure that it's all working as expected.
All right, so at this point, we don't really know how well it's working.
I haven't gone back to see what the stats are. We knew that we had fill rates of 85%, and with only a month or a month and a half under our belt, it's a little too early to have a definitive determination that it's better or worse or different or no change.
All right, and the school board considered a policy revision to substitute teachers yesterday. What would that do?
You know, I didn't read that one. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Nope, just appreciate the opportunity to talk about what's happening in the school district.
All right, Todd Halber is the business administrator for Park City School District. Thanks for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council meeting and work session starting at 3:30 to discuss the finance plan for the Arts and Culture District. On the phone with me, I've got Park City Manager Matt Dias. Also in the studio with me, I've got Park City Mayor Andy Behrman. So thanks for being with us. Matt, let me start with you. The Arts and Culture District here, still $88+ million. We're talking about up to 70 affordable housing units to be paid for with the transient room tax. Now we're talking about another tax, the additional resort community sales tax. What is that and what does that mean?
So, you know, just to take a step back, we've been spending the last 2 or 3 months taking a deep dive on all things arts and culture. I think given the uncertainty created by COVID and the escalating real estate market and construction costs, you know, we took a large step back and analyzed design, value engineering, anything we could to better manage the cost of the project. But I think, you know, moving forward, we had to come up with some additional ways to pay for the escalating cost of the project. But, you know, just to back up, although it's, you know, roughly $90 million in totality, you know, I want to be really clear that, you know, at least a third of that is actually our housing costs. So, you know, the city is prepared to spend, you know, upwards of $30 million on housing in the district. There's transportation money for the district, walkability money in the district. And so, you know, maybe we haven't done, you know, a good enough job at really explaining that story publicly. Although, you know, the costs have escalated, we are making a significant investment if we were to move forward in various critical community priorities.
Yeah, so it sounds like, though, we're talking about now having to bond for capital projects instead of paying cash for them. Sure, we can make this Arts and Culture District work, but is it the right thing to do? Is it the smart thing to do?
Well, I mean, that's a fair question, and I think the good news is we have a viable and responsible financial path forward. Nonetheless, it absolutely requires real commitment. It requires policy commitment. It requires financial commitment. And of course, there are opportunity costs. And those are some of the things that we've been, you know, discussing over the last several months and taking additional public stakeholder input, you know, value engineering the project. But I think the good news is that we absolutely have a responsible path forward if this is still the priority. I mean, it will take several years of construction. It will further our housing goals. It will further our transportation goals. It will use the transient room tax as initially proposed. And so there's a lot of things in here that at least at a staff level and a professional level, we can really get behind.
Okay, so what is this other tax then that we're talking about? Who's paying for it? And how much is it?
The additional resort community sales tax is a sales tax that's available to resort towns of a certain size that have a great deal of visitation. So this is a tax that traditionally our community has reinvested in infrastructure and open space to date. And so we would be broadening the definition of what we would be potentially spending that money on, to include arts and culture. So to take a step back, again, drawing money out of the resort economy, drawing money out of the visitation economy, and reinvesting it into Park City Arts and Culture District.
So we're not talking about increasing that 1% resort city sales tax. We're just talking about expanding the uses of it.
That's right. We're just talking about broadening that definition. And you know, the reason that revenue source was viewed upon favorably as staff for its potential was because it was further leveraging the benefits of the resort economy to create something here for locals, to affordable housing, to create arts, culture, and economy.
Okay, it's going to be a 2.5-hour discussion and pretty comprehensive. So also, council will be getting an update on the property that the city owns there at 100 Mar- Marsac Avenue. A lot of opposition to this, to build what had contemplated about 5 affordable units in a kind of a difficult location. So why not just sell it and let a private developer figure that out and then use the money towards housing?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely an alternative. I think the existing position of City Council is that land has become so valuable and so expensive that we're in a hold position for city assets unless we can redisposition it for furthering a critical community priority such as housing. So there's nothing to prevent this council from selling it to the highest bidder or trying to repurpose it for housing. But the existing position was sort of to land bank the property. Now, we received a petition, from the neighbors right around when COVID really took off. And so we didn't have a formal opportunity to acknowledge that petition, acknowledge the work of the neighbors in the neighborhood. And we wanted to do that. And that was important to council. Okay. So, presumably on Thursday evening, council could give us direction to maintain the status quo or potentially change the direction for this property.
Yeah, it sounds like, though, many of those people just want the property left as open space. Is that what this is about, though?
It did sound like that, and I think that's the intent of the petition, and I think the petition, has made some arguments for the cost of construction there or the associated impacts of traffic and congestion. But the previous direction of our city council prior to receiving this petition was just to land bank it. Land's so valuable, so scarce in town, that they would defer a decision or kick the decision to a future council to make in the future in some other day.
Okay. What's the update on the Gordo parcel where the Soils Repository and Recycle Utah are scheduled to go?
Well, good news all in all. I think, long term, we're resolving a really nagging issue with a really serious impact for taxpayers potentially. Anytime that the city creates a infrastructure project, we typically have very expensive soil remediation costs. And for a number of years, we've been trying to find out a way to reduce those costs and reduce the burden to our taxpayers. So, the way the crow flies sort of across from the film studio, but protected by a berm there on your way into town on 248, there's a collection of properties there where we have already submitted an application to make a small soil repository. So long term, this could be a huge savings to the taxpayers. It would reduce the municipality's obligation to truck contaminated soils down to Tooele and pay tipping fees. And I think the environmental agencies look upon it favorably to keep these disturbed soils as close to their origin as possible.
All right, and the city wants to acquire some property, some UDOT property there. If you can't get it, what does that mean?
Well, if we can't get it, we're probably going to have to reposition some of the city uses. We're also hoping to keep a Recycle Utah facility in town. So we would have at this location contemplating a soils repository, a small public works facility, a public trailhead to have access to the open space, and then a Recycle Utah facility. So if that were the case, if we were unable to pick up this additional sliver of property, everyone else might need to take a diet, so to speak, on what their expectations are.
Okay, big agenda again. The meeting starting at 3:30 again with the Arts and Culture District in the work session. Matt, hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Appreciate it.
And the Park City Mayor and City Council also holding its annual State of the City address last night. And in the studio with a recap of this year's message, Mayor Andy Behrman. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the city had some big goals a year ago, but as we all know, things changed quickly with the coronavirus pandemic. You still characterize 2020, though, as a year of big little things and cited incremental progress on many city priorities. Now that we're kind of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel here with the pandemic, which of the community's priorities will take center stage this year?
Well, I think a large theme in the State of Park City last night was talking about our Vision 2020, which we completed last February or March, and we're really excited to launch into that right when COVID hit. And so we had to do some immediate retooling and respond to the crisis. And in the meantime, I think we took the advantage to do some pilot projects and some smaller things, which I was calling our big little things and talked about. But at this point, it's time to start ramping up looking back to our Vision Vision 2020, start developing strategic plans. What I rolled out last night was a preview of some messaging, trying to figure out how do we combine our prior visioning work from the last few times we've done this, and you know, we've created values and priorities and plans, and now we have pillars, and how do we merge those into a unified message that honors both our past, our present, and where we want to go. And so we rolled out the first version of that, which I hope kickstarts the conversation.
Yeah, you compared the pandemic with another Park City disaster, the fire of 1898, and you said the difference between then and now is that Park City didn't learn from its mistakes after the fire. So what mistakes did we learn from last year then?
I think what I was trying to get at is after the fire, we rebuilt the city out of wood. And that had two effects. One was we burned down several other times, at least pieces. And secondly, we weren't really viewed as a permanent community. People weren't investing long-term in Park City. Even in the case a few years after the fire, the county seat moved to Colville or stayed in Colville when it was thought about bringing here because this is where all the population was. And the argument was, well, Park City is not building to last. They're not going to be here in 50 years. So we need to invest in the communities that are building out of limestone and putting solid foundations down. So when we look at today, and I talked about, we weren't physically damaged, and we were certainly economically damaged, but we've survived that. But what it's exposed is our social vulnerabilities and our lack of safety nets and how our most vulnerable populations in town have been hit the hardest by this pandemic. And luckily, our community has been very generous and rose up and bridged that gap, but that's treating the symptoms, not the root causes. So what I'm encouraging us to do is look at how do we build those safety nets and create better equity in the community so we have a solid foundation going forward.
Well, Governor Spencer Cox has called the pandemic a once-in-a-century event with, talking about future preventative measures earlier in the month. I mean, do you see Park City having some sort of pandemic protocol going into the future, even if this is a once-in-a-century kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's once in a century. I think that's optimistic. So I think it's something that all of our planning ought to look at going forward. And I often compare this. I think everybody's heard from me. I have a great deal of concern about climate change, and I think that's shared across the community. And I look at this as the pandemic was one of those existential threats that everybody thought would happen someday, but we didn't really prepare for. And I think climate's a very similar one, and we can learn lessons from this and prepare for things like a pandemic, things like climate, and build resilience and build better safety nets in our community.
Yeah, did the city, and I'm trying to look for the House bill that kind of quashed the increased fees for electric vehicles mm-hmm. and stuff. Did the city push for the failure of that?
It was something that I believe the league opposed, and certainly we expressed our opposition. I don't believe we actively lobbied against that. We've really been focused on some of these land use bills that have been they're bad. They're something that would really impact us heavily, and also the ADU bill, which I think is nice in concept, but has the ability to potentially increase short-term rentals in all the core of our neighborhoods, which is just going to go to the heart of our affordability. We've already seen the inability to monitor these short-term rentals and allow them in all kinds of neighborhoods has removed what little workforce housing we have left, and it's just going to get worse. So that's where we've been primarily focused.
Well, back to your address, one of the key points last night was highlighting how issues like traffic and housing affordability aren't necessarily modern Park City problems, and you actually used old newspaper headlines from decades ago to illustrate this. But even though these problems are generational, they certainly are compounded, I think, over the years. How urgent is it to find solutions now?
Oh, it's very urgent. And I think it was urgent historically as well. The idea for the state of the city actually came to me as I was listening to a podcast with John Meacham, who is a famous historian. And he was talking about how we have a tendency to focus on the present. Present is always the worst time ever. And that's why he was stressing the importance of history for perspective and realizing how each generation has their challenges and how important it is each generation tackle those challenges. Where we're faced today, I think the challenges of traffic and housing and are more complex than they ever were. They're more expensive, but that doesn't mean we should back down. And in fact, I think the idea of being bold is important because you look at traffic, We can add all the buses we want. We can try to squeeze out efficiencies. But the reality is, as long as we're a car-centric town that's located in a narrow valley with no parking and only two roads in, we're going to have traffic to some degree. So we need to start to reconsider how our town functions and see if we can come up with a new vision where we're a car-optional town and we have better ways to move people around if we truly want to eradicate traffic.
Well, and as you mentioned, we really can't widen the roads or easily build new ones with the mountains surrounding us. So what would some of those bold solutions look like regarding transit for 2021?
You know, we're going to be rolling out a lot of those ideas in the next year, so I don't want to get too far ahead of it. But some things I think we've talked about is large park and rides on the outside of town, and whether we bring people by bus, by rail, by aerial in from those to the core of town and move people around internally with microtransit or, again, one of those other forms of transportation. I think that'll help. I also think active transportation is something we could use better in town. Continue to increase pedestrian and bike safety and connections that people can move around, choosing not to use cars. And then lastly, where we put our workforce housing and where people live and how we plan our land going forward is going to determine how people move around and how close they are to their jobs and their activities. And that's something that you can't go back in time and fix what we've done, but going forward, we can be smarter about that.
Yeah. You made the point that bold action doesn't necessarily mean big, expensive, or disruptive. So can you give us an example of a bold action that the city has taken or will take that isn't big, expensive, or disruptive, but has made a difference?
Wow. That's a great question, and I'd have to put some time into thinking about that. But I would say, you know, some areas that I would say we've been bold over the years and we've been really successful. Transit's been one of those. We predicted that someday we were going to be a successful resort town, and we put a transit district in place in the 70s. And it started out with just a couple of buses and what was kind of a dial-a-ride or an early version of microtransit. And that's something that's incrementally grown and we've added to over the years, and most recently we've added express lanes. And so I won't say it wasn't expensive, but it was something we've done piece by piece, and we've been able to address the challenges.
Well, thinking of transit and traffic and circulation, how much of a role should Park City play in finding a solution to what will be problems like that at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, especially if this PEG development project goes through?
It's something they're absolutely going to have to address. They're not going to get approvals without addressing how they're going to handle traffic. And what we found is it's been difficult because PEG is operating separate from Vail. And so we really need the mountain speaking with the developer and figuring out and working with us on a comprehensive traffic plan. So I think we've got everybody coming to the table. We'll have those conversations. But that is something they're going to have to address before they can move forward with development.
You and council members made a plea for more public engagement with city government this year. Given how we have kind of moved all of the meetings virtually in 2020, people can now be at home eating dinner, taking care of their kids, not without having to show up at the MARSAC building. So what, given that, how do you think things move forward in terms of meeting the public?
I think what you're going to see moving forward is a hybrid. It's really hard to replace in-person meetings, and I personally would hate to see those go. I think they lose when you don't have the nonverbals there, when you don't have everybody in a room, it has a very different feel. And I think particularly when you try to look long-term and strategy and some of the deeper thinking is difficult to do on Zoom. That being said, we've learned that a lot more people can engage as we go digital. So I think going forward, we've already installed some new equipment in council chambers for better sound. We'll probably install video, and I believe we'll probably do hybrid meetings going forward.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I just want to thank everybody that came out last night. There was some debate whether we should move forward with this, but we really felt this year more than any, we need to bring everybody together and try to celebrate what we've accomplished and look to the future. So thanks to the hundreds of folks that tuned in.
Okay. Mayor Andy Bierman, thanks for your time this morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Heber City Airport reported its busiest year ever in 2020. This while the city is moving forward with updating its airport master plan. On the phone, I have Heber City Manager Matt Brower, along with a civil engineer from TO Engineers, Jeremy McAllister. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so Matt, I'm going to start with you. The Heber Valley Airport Twitter account posted arrivals and departures from 2019 through mid-January this year. Already January up from the same time last year. And it looks like at a high of January, we went from like 47 arrivals and departures to something like 35 for 2020. So what do you attribute this to?
You know, I don't know. We're seeing a significant increase in city facilities across the board, not only at the airport, but in traffic on Main Street, in our restaurants. So we're seeing a lot of interest in Heber during the pandemic. So I think it's something that we've seen over 2020, and it's quite hard to explain, quite frankly.
Yeah, and even last July, in the midst of the pandemic, numbers went way up. I mean, we would see, like, from 2019, 25 of the count up to, like, 55. So is it perhaps because of the pandemic, people hiring a private jet so they're not having to fly commercial? Or do we just have a lot of people with a lot more money moving to town?
I think part of it is a lot of people moving to town. We have the Red Ledges development in Heber, and we're seeing a big uptick in the number of people who live in Heber that own aircraft at the airport. So I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is people are coming into our valley to get away from the large metropolitan areas. I think that's the other part of it.
Yeah. So the Airport Advisory Board met in January and spent some time getting an update on the master plan from Jeremy McAllister. Matt, can you kind of give us an idea of where we're at and where we are headed with the master plan?
Well, I'm excited to announce that after a year hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we are looking to kickstart the master planning process with a virtual open house on April 1st. And so we're excited to get this thing kicked off again and looking forward to get the public's input. I might add that we have a website that's at hebervalleyflightpath.com that we're going to use for everything related to the airport master plan. It's going to be timely information, accurate information. Invite the public again to go to HeberValleyFlightPath.com for all the information related to the airport master planning process.
So does the city already have an airport master plan? Is the new one is replacing something?
Yes, we already have an airport master plan, but it's outdated, and we're required to at least update them about every 5 years. No different than updating the city's general plan. And so we're in the process of updating the airport master plan. But this one will be unique in that what we have found through the forecast is that we're seeing larger aircraft coming to the airport, which means we got to consider the facilities they need so they can fly in and take off and land safely.
So is the airport expanding, or is it just becoming more dense with new services?
So the airport is made up of about 400 acres, and the facility expansion can take place in the existing footprint. We have enough space to provide for the expansion of the facilities. What we will see, though, is an expansion in the safety areas, what we call the runway protection zones and the object-free zones. Those areas will expand, but there will be nothing built in them because they're intended to protect the aircraft as they come in and take off from the airport.
So we are also going to allow larger jets then to fly in and out?
So Heber cannot restrict any aircraft that can fly into the airport safely. One of the agreements we have with the FAA is that we can't discriminate against aircraft. If they can fly in safely, we have to let them come in and land and take off. In the same way that we couldn't restrict you, Leslie, from driving to downtown Main Street. You have the right to drive downtown, and we couldn't restrict your access. So because of our agreements with the FAA, we cannot restrict aircraft from using the airport safely.
So it's my understanding that no new commercial development can happen at the airport until this master plan is done?
Generally, that is correct, unless the Heber City Council makes findings that an exception or relief is necessary. And the reason for that is we want the airport master plan to run its paces, to work through the process, and not be influenced by any type of project or any type of request. We want to make sure that the master planning process is done independently and it's done objectively.
Okay, so Jeremy, at January's meeting, you had reported that the Heber Valley flight path had been delayed. So you were referring to the website then?
I was referring to the REV's website and also just the master plan process itself. One of the major elements that is going to be critical in the master plan effort is that of public involvement. And so with the pandemic, you know, we've the new normal, we've really had to adjust our approach in soliciting the public input and also getting the public outreach efforts effectively out there. So yeah, we have seen a delay both, I would say, in the Flight Path website as well, but more importantly, I would say the delay was just in the public outreach effort.
All right. So it sounds like now that we will have a draft that the public can start commenting on then by April 1st for that public hearing?
Yeah. So if you go to the Heber Valley Flight Path website, we actually have already published 3 of the draft chapters of the master plan for anybody to download and view. What we're talking about for the April 1st open house is to restart the public open house process, but also to focus on what will be the 4th chapter of the master plan, which is the forecast, which takes a deep dive look into the traffic that we're currently receiving, but also the anticipated traffic over the next. We look at 3 time intervals. They're called the short term, the medium term, and the long term. And so we look at a 0 to 5 year, a 5 to 10 year, and then out to 20 year snapshot of what we anticipate the traffic to be.
And can you share that with us? I mean, what is that looking like at this point?
Sure. We can. So the forecast, as you alluded to earlier, has been impacted in a very unique way for the aviation industry with COVID. And so we did hit the pause button, and we are recalibrating some of our forecasts based off of 2020 numbers. While commercial service is down everywhere sharply, here in Heber, we've actually seen an uptick in general aviation. Commercial service being where you can actually buy a ticket and get on a flight and go somewhere. General aviation being just private pilots and then also including charters. So in Heber, we've seen an increase in traffic in terms of overall numbers. I would say the traffic type has stayed the same, but the volume has gone up. So going back to the previous master plan, it identified that the type of traffic that Heber was getting going clear back to, this is the early 2000s, was faster than what the airport was designed for. We actually, most people will say, oh, the master plan needs to accommodate larger aircraft. But technically, what is driving the conversation about increasing these safety areas is faster aircraft, not larger aircraft. And so the aircraft that are coming in faster need, you know, bigger buffers. I would compare them to runway shoulders on the highway, so to speak. We don't need to add another lane of traffic. Our capacity is just fine at the airport. We don't need to increase capacity. The runway can accommodate all of the traffic it's receiving. What it is inadequate for, and what the forecast will show, is that we're receiving more aircraft that are coming faster that require larger safety areas than what it was currently designed for.
Okay. And then, and in terms of the numbers, though, I mean, if we're at, 55 last July 4th, what do those numbers look like 20 years from now?
So the year-on-year increases are marginal. They're, you know, like 1-2%. And I don't have a draft forecast in front of me, so I apologize for that. But we will publish it on the website. So the trend line is gradual, but where the FAA has set a threshold is 500 operations. If an airport is receiving 500 operations of a traffic type that exceeds the safety standards of the airport, then the airport is required to look at the safety standards and determine does this airport need to accommodate or increase its safety standards to accommodate those operations of the either faster or bigger aircraft. In Heber's case, it's faster.
Okay. Real quick, before we go, Matt, I wanted just to get an update on the lawsuit between the city and OK Air 3. Can you give us that? Are you guys, has it been settled, or is that what you're working towards, or?
Yeah, I'm not able to comment on an ongoing lawsuit, but we are working feverishly to try to get it settled and get that behind us.
Okay, because it's been going on now for a few years, yeah?
It has, but I'm optimistic. I'm a hopeless optimist, and I believe that we'll get something resolved here shortly.
Okay. So, again, the news is that people can go online to HeberValleyFlightPath.com, have a look at some of the preliminary master plan figures, and again, plan to put April 1st on their calendar as a virtual open house. Okay.
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, Leslie, thanks for allowing us to come on, and just want to encourage the public to go to HeberValleyFlightPath.com. There they can register for updates. They can find the most latest and accurate information regarding the airport master plan, and we look forward to seeing everyone at the virtual open house on April 1st.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much for your time. The Sadoval Basin Planning Commission last night hosted a lengthy public hearing on the proposed Highland Flats residential development. The overall majority of the speakers opposing the project. The Planning Commission did not come to a vote on the proposal. Chairman Ryan Dickey noted that over 200 people were attending the meeting via Zoom. Some 55 people spoke again about the development, a proposal that would place 410 rental units on a location of about 41 acres. The expanse of the property is bounded by Highland Drive to the south and west, and then on the other side of the junction by Interstate 80 and U.S. 40. The developers say the plan would include 144 units planned as affordable housing, 180 as moderate or attainable housing. The project would not accommodate nightly rentals, but critics say that that large amount of density violates the general plan and is not compatible with the more rural character of Highland Estates.